Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Kreisman, and I am thrilled to be joined today by my friend Aparna Nancherla. She is an LA-based comedian whose stand-up has been seen on late-night TV, HBO, Netflix, Comedy Central, and The Occasional Meme. Aparna also wrote for and appeared on Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell and has contributed multiple op-eds to the New York Times. Her new book is called Unreliable Narrator, Me, Myself, and Imposter Syndrome. Welcome, Aparna.
Thanks, Maris. Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so happy you're here. I hope you'll take this question in the spirit with which I'll deliver it. There's so much talk online about imposter syndrome, and I would love to know what qualifies you to write the book on it.
That is a great question, and one I wrestled with many a night and day when I was writing or trying to write this book. But I would say my qualifications are perhaps a lifetime of self-doubt. And I think it's not uncommon, but imposter syndrome especially tends to really get kicked up sometimes the further along you are in your career, in that when you start to get maybe more opportunities or taken more seriously, then you really start to be like, wait a second, but everyone should know that I have no idea what I'm doing and don't belong here. Whereas when you're newer, maybe you don't necessarily feel that same pressure.
Yes, when you're in the basement of a club during an open mic, I guess, and a little bit easier.
Yeah, exactly. Though it was interesting because I talked to, or I did like an informal survey of like friends and random people when I was writing the book, and it did feel like a lot of people did experience it early on in their careers, but I think more in the sense of like that first job where they were being taken a chance on, they were like, but why did you believe in me?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So uncomfortable to be believed.
Yeah.
A big theme in this book is attention, both wanting it, wanting to be seen, and also not wanting to. And I'm wondering, you know, you're an actor and a comedian. Tell me a little bit about how you compromise between the two.
Yeah, I have a very love-hate relationship with attention. Like, I think part of it goes back to, you know, my parents were both Indian immigrants, and I kind of grew up in a very ambition-driven household where like achievement was sort of the gold standard. And so I think there was always a value system placed on, you know, standing out in sort of a positive way and kind of making people notice you because of kind of all the good things you were accomplishing. But then I think there was also a thing of like, don't stick out, and sort of this assimilationist thing of like, don't get too much attention or like, you know, people will use it against you. So it ended up being this very tricky balance of kind of, yeah, again, wanting to be seen, but then not wanting to be seen too much. So I think I've always kind of had that push-pull relationship with it, even in kind of pursuing a career that is so public-facing.
Yeah. And you have an essay about what it means to be introverted versus being shy, and that those two things aren't always one and the same.
Yeah.
And what drew you to performing in the first place as a shy introvert?
Yeah. I mean, to me, I think it feels, I don't think I'm alone in this, because I've definitely met other comedians who are also, kind of more reserved off stage, but I think there's just more control with the way you're engaging with other people when you're on a stage, and when you kind of have a planned idea of what you're going to say and how the interaction is going to go. And I think that feels, for whatever reason, more manageable than, just like day-to-day interaction or being like leading a meeting or something where it's a little bit more spontaneous and less in your control.
Control is incredibly important.
Control is a recurring theme for me.
I was delighted and shocked to learn that one of your examples is that Bridget Everett is an introvert. And it's so funny because I feel like, much like how you grew up in a very goal-oriented home,
yeah,
in this country, we also really reward the extroverts. like almost as like a bootstraps kind of thing.
Totally.
Tell me about like,
Well, I just to that point, I think you're totally right. And I think introverts also, a lot of times I've figured out, like with someone like Bridget Everett, where you're like, there's no way she's an introvert. Like a lot of us develop sort of an extrovert persona to kind of blend in and fulfill maybe parts of ourselves that feel the need to come out and be seen. But then, it's maybe not our default setting. On the other side, we kind of need to recharge or just like recalibrate.
Recharging. I mean, my husband Josh is a true extrovert, and I can't imagine, you know, you talk about how important it is to get up every night in the world of stand-up comedy. Mm-hmm. And if you find that interaction to not be energizing, how much more difficult that must be.
Yeah, I think for me, I just have to be a little more conscious around what takes energy out of me. Like, I think performing is obviously like kind of the goal with getting up on stage. But then there's also just, you know, interacting with other comedians in the green room or talking to audience after or before the show. And it's like all those little things kind of add up for me. So now I just have to be, especially as I've gotten older, more cognizant of like, okay, maybe you're not going to hang out at the show tonight, or maybe you can just like do your set and then go. And sometimes it does feel a little rude because I think we default to kind of being social and amenable to kind of just taking time with everyone. But yeah, I've had to kind of draw boundaries for myself that I think early on I felt like it wasn't really my right to draw those lines.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have an entire essay about being a people pleaser, and that is very relatable. And that often forces you to put other people ahead of your own needs.
Yeah. I think that also comes from, that sort of immigrant mentality of like, don't make too many waves. And kind of like go along with the everyone else. But yeah, I think it's also probably in every industry, but I think especially in show business, like a lot of times if you're not making those asks for yourself, no one's like going out of their way to make sure that you're being fully taken care of or seen after. So I think as I've progressed in my career, I've been like, okay, sometimes you're just going to have to point blank be like, I'm not going to do this, or I need this and this. Like, people aren't going to mind read in that way, and it's okay to be a little pushy about it.
I love that. And another thing that you talk about in terms of show business is, I'm quoting you to you, the Hollywood beauty standard can be summed up as fuck you. Tell me about existing in that world and like having some self-esteem or trying to hold on to some shred of.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't feel fully in tune with like the current trends or culture, but it does seem to me like there is some degree more like body positivity and like comfortability with just being seen in whatever form you feel like being seen in the younger generations. And I don't feel like that was necessarily the case when I was growing up. Like, it felt like there was more of a one body standard we were all struggling to meet in whatever way, shape, or form we found was attainable for us. And so I've kind of been on my own body journey with being in such a hypercritical industry. But I do think for me, I've been lucky in that I haven't really like driven with my appearance in terms of like what my work revolves around, or being like super about like, look at me. Like I sort of feel like I drive my point of view with my brain and sort of what's going on the inside rather than the outside. So in that sense, I don't think I felt the same pressure to kind of continually conform to a certain standard. But yeah, I certainly, like, you know, you'll have your photo shoot or you'll have some acting job where you just feel like, oh my gosh, like I do not even look like I'm the same species as this like woman next to me. Like, what am I doing here? But Yeah, I think I've been lucky in that I haven't felt like that's something I've really had to rely on strongly as like what's getting me a seat at the table.
And yet you do talk in so many different essays in the book about how, of course, an audience is going to judge you first on your physical appearance.
Yeah, I think that's the weird contradiction with it, where it is like, especially with stand-up, it's like whatever that first, you know, 10 or 15 seconds when you come out on stage, what you sound like, what you look like, what kind of energy you're putting out, that is the audience's initial read on you, whether you like it or not. And so I think I've always been like, all right, well, they're going to think whatever they're going to think. But now I'm going to sort of take control of like what we're doing, or like talk about what really interests me. And I think early on, I felt more of a need to maybe make them more comfortable or make them like get me more. But I think now I'm at a place where I feel a little okay just being like, yeah, it's okay if you don't get it right away or you don't get it at all. Like I'm fine with that.
Absolutely. Before we go on to anything else, one thing I really wanted to talk to you about was the notes section in the back of the book, because it is thorough. You've done rigorous research for this book. Tell me about that. It's not just like the essays we all read online and the book of essays. It's medical papers. It's a whole bunch of things.
I was a undergraduate psych major, so I think I know how to cite a reference, but for me, I think it's just that part of my brain that I always, and maybe it's fair when you're writing a book about self-doubt, but being like, I don't know what I'm talking about. Like, let me actually reference someone who does know what they're talking about. So I think that led to, in writing the essays, very much being like, whenever I stumbled on something that made me think about something differently or just like shed light on a topic in a way I hadn't seen before, I was like, well, I'm just going to go ahead and throw you in the book too. And like sometimes it just feels like as a word nerd and a like lifelong reader, I'm just like, well, this person put it better than I could, so I'm just gonna have to include this. And it almost feels like sometimes for me as a writer, if I'm really influenced by something someone else says, I'm like, well, I'm not gonna just act like I thought of that by myself.
That's like, that's smart.
Yeah.
how do you keep track of all of those things? That this is a real process question, which I know you're not doing.
No, I think that's I wish I had like a good system, because I know there's like programs now where you can sort of, I think Scrivener and like stuff like that, where you can sort of organize everything. But mine was sort of a messy process of like just having various Google Docs and then even the notes app on my phone, where I'd be like, okay, these are the sources for this essay. It was a real mishmash, I'd say.
I wanted to know about that because I am also in the middle of trying to write a book.
Yeah.
And there are so many things to be unsure about. And your essay about procrastination really felt like a shot through the heart. Tell me about writing this book as a chronic procrastinator.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I think I, like many maybe procrastinators and many perfectionists, I sort of had this idea in my head of what it looked like to write the book. And then it was so very wrong and like inaccurate of like what actually writing anything is like, that, yeah, I think I really had to meet myself in the middle in terms of being like, okay, you're going to write from like 11 p.m. to 12 a.m. today, and you're going to, you know, maybe get 3 good paragraphs, and that's going to have to be okay. So it's a lot of like trying to be nicer to myself of like, you're not necessarily going to be the person who's like, I'm at the writing center for 7 hours, 5 days a week. And yeah, because I think I have very, my attention span tends to ebb and flow, and a lot of it is just around anxiety, where it's like I'll sit down and write and then I'll just start to feel really like uncomfortable or like self-critical, and then I'll just have to switch to something else, and that doesn't feel like writing. But I think for me it's just as important to kind of do the writing as it is to kind of step away from it, if that makes sense.
That is very comforting. And another concept that I took away from that essay that I will put in my own Google Doc so I can quote you someday is that I hadn't considered how perfectionists really are set up to procrastinate because everything is kind of perfect until you actually start to process it.
Totally. Right. Yeah. I think in my mind, there's like, I don't know if this is a philosophy thing I learned a long time ago, but maybe it was Plato, but it's like sort of, there's like a golden ideal or like example, like of the perfect chair, like all the ideas of the chair are just trying to approach this one perfect chair. And I think for me, there is this like golden thing I create that's just perfect and unimpeachable and flawless, and I'm just forever trying to reach it and nothing ever quite comes close. It's just so disappointing to ever come close to it. So it's just like everything I do, I kind of self-sabotage because I realize that once I start, I'll just be re-reminded of how imperfect my actual work is.
And accepting that is a lifelong
stuff. I also was like, I'll write a book about self-doubt and it will fix my perfectionism. And then it's like, no, you're just going to be especially disappointed in your book about self-doubt.
I was really struck by how you talk about racial diversity in comedy and how we're still at the point right now where if you are diverse at all, you then have to you have to be everything to everyone. You have to be the spokesperson for that. And how similar that is to talking about mental illness. It seems like, and I am guilty of this, we have an expectation of what a depressed person or an anxious person will look like. Tell me about that. I think
it is really interesting because I'll even have that thing where, you know, I'll have sort of the petty human thought at a show where it's like, you know, I used to talk about depression, anxiety on stage and, you know, I might be the only person who talked about that night. And now I feel like every comedian I see is sort of like, and I struggle with anxiety and I struggle
with
depression.
You started a trend.
I don't know if I was responsible because there were definitely people, you know, talking about mental health before I was, but I do feel like since then it's become even more common. And in my head, I'll just be like, oh no, like, what is my thing now? That was supposed to be my thing. And now it's everyone's thing. And yeah, even in my own head, I'll like flatten myself sometimes into sort of like, what's my hook? Like what makes me stand out from everyone else? And like forgetting that I am like a three-dimensional human and not just like, you know, reduced to these like three qualifications of like, you know, brown person, soft-spoken, mental illness. Like, it's hard when you're in kind of this world that's so driven by being a marketplace that you need to be like, what are my selling points or something. Like I continually wrestle with that in my own self, like I think making sense of myself as an artist, where I'm like, have to remember sometimes it's like what you're saying, it's not just like the package that you're saying it with.
Yeah, and you even talk about like the disconnect between when you were doing material on anxiety and depression, how there was a disconnect between what you were saying to the audience and what you're presenting and what was actually going on inside your head.
Yeah, because I think anytime you make, you know, more personal stuff or more vulnerable stuff into work that's then commodified, it just changes your relationship to it. And obviously the sort of more polished presentational edited form of it is never going to be like the same as the actual experience or how you reckon with it as a person in your day to day. So I think trying to make those line up for me never quite worked. So it always felt like a little bit of a deception in a way of being like, yeah, I struggle with these things. Because sometimes people would ask me like, how do you write about it? Like, I just struggle and I can't really make sense of it. And I think for me, it is a little bit of a compartmentalization or even just like a separation of like, this is anxiety and depression, you know, TM in the work. And then there's like the actual experience, which is a lot messier and not not at all presentational. Like, if anything, it's probably like why I canceled my spot.
Yeah. And one of the things I love in when you talk about anxiety, which I hadn't put together before this, is the idea of horror movies and we get out of them and the catharsis that we're seeking versus the reality of how we feel. Tell me about watching Midsommar.
I have such a weird relationship with horror movies because I think I'm very attracted to them, maybe as both someone who is constantly worrying, but also I think sometimes my mood can get really low. And then I think horror is sort of that genre where it's like, you know, you're walking on the edge of like what is acceptable or like what is shocking or like beyond belief or like too grotesque. And so it kind of is like sometimes the only thing that can generate a feeling in me if I'm feeling really low. So I think there is, yeah, that catharsis I find in it. But then I think for me, I watch them and I expect like some sort of grander catharsis. And then it never happens. I just leave walking away kind of like horrified, but also like, but now I'm back at where I was before. And that's not fair. You know, like I expect them to somehow like do the work for me. But yeah, there is something about them where I feel like they just play at that edge of like reality between what we accept in the day to day versus like what is going on in our heads, which is so rarely matches up exactly. And it kind of goes into those places in our mind that we never let ourselves otherwise. And so something about that draws me to them over and over again.
I didn't write this down, but you have a great quote about horror movies being dragged.
Yeah, they're also campy. I feel like even the ones that are just like, you know, straight slasher films, it is still like it is kind of the grand drama of like what a life can be. And so there is, yeah, to me, something ultimately like very theatrical and like, over the top.
I love that. And speaking of theatrical and over the top, you're inspiring because you have stopped basically checking social media.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
The Swifties came for you. I'd forgotten that.
It did. I'm sure they've come for other people harder, but
yes,
even
indeed.
Like one afternoon of being mildly targeted by Swifties was like more than my fragile ego could take.
And so aside from who's paying attention to you, this is when you turn it around a little bit and you start thinking about what you choose to pay attention to.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if, like, again, I think I'm looking for a magic bullet here, but like, have your thought processes changed outside of the world of groupthink?
Yeah, I mean, I have friends who are like, do you feel so much better? Like, are you just like happier? And I wouldn't say it's like cured me at all, but I will say it's like created space that I think I didn't even realize I was missing when I was just on the platforms all the time, of just maybe like being able to decide things for myself or just really have perspective, I think, on what is important to me. Because I feel like when you have so many other people's voices in your head all the time, you kind of lose sight of whose voice matters or like your own voice. And so I think for me, because I think some people are good at, you know, keeping social media in its lane and being like, this is a fun thing I check sometimes. But for me, I just like couldn't handle that big a cacophony of other people's opinions. Cause I think I have been so driven by a life of like seeing what everyone else is doing to make sure I'm like aligned correctly. And with social media, you're getting so many conflicting ideas of how to be or what's good, what's bad. Like it kind of left me like unable to do anything in terms of making a decision or knowing how to be.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like social media is the worst place to try to get involved in gray areas or to be unsure about just about anything.
I know it. I feel like that's where they, but that is, my life is like one big gray area. Like that's where I live, you know, like I'm changing my mind on things like in the same hour. So it's like, social media felt like I was like, oh no, I don't think I can survive here for long without being, completely confused.
I want to learn from you.
I will. I will say also, like, because we are in a world so driven by social media and just in careers that I think very much go off of these platforms, like it's not the best decision I've made either. Like there are things I'm very out of the loop on. There's things that I'm sure, you know, my marketing team would love if I did more of. But I think for me at this point in my life, I'm just like, I can't do it. It's too hard. I can't.
That's sort of seems to go back to being able to say no sometimes.
Yeah.
Before I ask you for book recommendations, Aparna, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the comedy scene right now.
Sure.
Because I think I think of you as so important to like the alt scene in Brooklyn or in LA, but the larger institution still hasn't changed all that much.
I know it's kind of weird to think about because I still like mainly am not a club comedian. I mainly have always performed in more alternative spaces and sort of done my own thing in terms of climbing up the ladder. But yeah, it's kind of weird to me in how like some things still feel very much like still in rooted in this culture of like, you know, like everyone's too sensitive and we should be able to say whatever we want. And but then there's also it feels like there's a vanguard of like younger comedians doing very different things and kind of pushing the envelope both in terms of just like style and form, but also just like what they want to talk about or how they want to show up. I think the internet has democratized things to some degree, but then it still feels like at the end of the day, it's like, what are your numbers and do your numbers translate into something we can sell? So I think it's hard. Like I'm excited about the progress that has been made, but it still feels like everything is still very much in thrall to capitalism. And you worry about like, is it just a trend that you're really into diverse voices right now? Like, I think that's always my kind of hesitation with it. Where what we were talking about earlier, where it's like, is your identity just like hot right now?
You have a hot identity. So maybe before I ask you about books, I'm wondering if you could just mention a couple of comedians that people should watch out for.
Oh, yeah, there are so many. I mean, there's so many I love, so I know I'm going to leave people out. But I guess just off the top of my head, comedians I've seen recently who I was delighted by are, Chike Robinson. He's a comedian based here in L.A. He's very funny. I think he originally started in Flint, Michigan. And then Anna Saragina, she's another LA comedian. She does a lot of stuff that's really physical and really kind of cool and I would say almost avant-garde. I don't know if that's a weird way to describe a comedian, but it's very like sort of meta and outside the box and it's really great. And Jess Tom is a New York comedian I really love and I've seen kind of grow up over the years. And yeah, they're awesome. Those are just three.
I think I have seen Jess Tom at your show, Butter Boy.
Yes, yes.
So now, please give us some book recommendations, Aparna.
Okay, so I'm someone who reads like all the time. Like almost I also use reading just as fully as procrastination where I'm just like, well, I'm reading. It's clearly it's still a worthwhile and good use of my time. When people ask me, I never remember a single thing I've read, which I know is probably horrifying to every author I've read. But, okay, so a book that I just read was Users by Colin Winnett. And it was really good. It was like fiction, but it's sort of commenting on like big tech and how it informs our realities, and how it's kind of about this guy who works at a big tech company. It's kind of how his life is falling apart, both professionally and personally. But it just was a really cool, like the way he wrote it is just really cool. And the writing style was really fun. So that I just read and would recommend. And then one that I'm currently reading is They Called Us Exceptional and Other Lies That Raised Us by Prachi Gupta. And it's very much about what we were talking about earlier, just the Indian American experience of growing up in like sort of a high achieving family, and kind of with everything looking picture perfect on the outside. And then it often like obscures like very real traumas and things that are happening at home that just never get shed light on because of this pressure to stay perfect. And yeah, it's really hitting home, and I'm like taking my time with it, but I think a lot of people will probably resonate with it. And then lastly, I'll do a book I haven't read yet, but I've been like kind of saving up as a treat, Saving Time by Jenny Odell. 'Cause I read her first book, How to Do Nothing. And it really like struck a hard nerve with me. So I think this one, I'm just like, oh, it's about time, and capitalism is like my catnip.
Perfect. I'm going to add that I went to the release party for Murder on Sex Island by Joe Firestone last night.
Oh my God. And I can't believe I didn't say Murder on Sex Island.
This wasn't to call you out. This was just, I saw your name in the acknowledgments. I think of you. We missed your presence last night, and I cannot wait to read that one.
Yes, Murder on Sex Island by Joe Firestone. It's also available as a podcast, which I would highly recommend because it's her reading it out loud.
Which is also my cue to say the audiobook for Unreliable Narrator is a delight. And
thank you.
Yeah. So if you're listening to this and want to keep listening, that's how you do it. Well, thank you, Alparna. Unreliable Narrator out now.
Thank you, Maris. Thanks for the interview.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.